Hi, I'm Dr. Huey, and this afternoon I'm going to discuss some common breast disorders. Welcome to OBGYN 101, the Gray Hair Notes. I'm Dr. Huey, the gray-haired OBGYN from Chicago, and these gray hair notes were designed to accompany the Junior Medical Student Manual, OBGYN 101. This manual is freely available at the website www.obgyn101.org. More of these audio notes can be found at grayhairobgyn.com. At puberty, the female breast develops under the influence of estrogen, progesterone, growth hormone, prolactin, insulin, and probably thyroid hormone, parathyroid hormone, and cortisol. This complex process typically begins between ages 8 to 14 and spans about 4 years. The breast contains mostly fat tissue, connective tissue, and glands that following pregnancy will produce milk. The milk is collected in the ducts and transported to 15 to 25 openings that exit through the nipple. During the menstrual cycle, the breast is smallest on days 4 through 7, and then begins to enlarge under the influence of estrogen and later progesterone and prolactin. Maximum breast size occurs just prior to the onset of menses. The breast is not round, but has a tail of breast tissue extending up into the armpit. This is clinically significant because abnormalities can arise there just as they can in other areas of the breast. Breasts are never identical, comparing right to left. One is invariably a little larger, slightly different in shape, and located differently on the chest wall. The nipples are likewise never identical, but show minor differences in size, location, and orientation. The breast is divided into quadrants to better describe and compare clinical findings. The upper outer quadrant is the area of greatest mass of breast tissue. It's also the area in which about half of all breast cancers will develop. During adolescence, several breast growth problems can be troubling to the adolescent and her family. Among these are unusually early breast development, unusually delayed breast development, unusually large breasts, also called mammary hypertrophy, unusually small breasts, asymmetrical breast growth, and breast lumps. Initial breast development occurs on average at age 9 with the appearance of a breast bud. The normal range for breast bud appearance is from ages 8 to 13. It's common for one bud to appear up to 6 months prior to the second bud appearing. Breast growth is then progressive, with enlargement of the breast tissue, areola, and papillae, and change in shape and contour. By age 18, breast development is usually complete. Premature thalarche is breast development prior to the age of 8 in the absence of pubic hair development. We evaluate these children to rule out estrogen-producing ovarian tumors, ingestion of estrogen-containing compounds, and the rare, true, precocious puberty. Delayed telarche reflects absence of any breast development by age 13. Asymmetric breast growth during adolescence is the rule rather than the exception. Reassure the patient that the asymmetry usually evens out by the time of full maturation. Even at maturity, breasts are rarely 100% symmetrical, so minor degrees in asymmetry are expected. Because the breasts are continuing to grow and change, we usually delay any surgical intervention for asymmetry until after age 18. Mammary hypertrophy can be a distressing symptom. Because growth and development continues for a long time, if we are contemplating surgical intervention, we generally delay the surgery until the breasts are fully mature. Breast masses in adolescence are essentially 100% benign. Because of this, surgery, such as excisional biopsy or fine needle aspiration, is almost never warranted. Further, the surgical disruption of architecture can be disfiguring as the breast continues to mature. Supernumerary breasts are relatively common. They are found along the milk line, extending from the axilla to the groin. Most of them are not noticed clinically until pregnancy occurs. Then, under the influence of the pregnancy hormones, the breasts enlarge in preparation for lactation. It's at this time that soft swellings along the milk line occur, representing supernumerary breasts. During lactation, the extra breasts may produce milk. These are not dangerous and are generally ignored. If they prove to be a cosmetic problem, they can be removed surgically. More common than supernumerary breasts are supernumerary nipples. Like extra breasts, these are located in the milk line and are not dangerous. Unless they are large, they are usually not noticed until a pregnancy, and at that time, like the normal nipples, they enlarge and darken. Usually nipples point outward. Sometimes they invert. When they persistently point inwards, they are called inverted nipples. This can be unilateral or bilateral. With stimulation and nipple erection, most inverted nipples will evert. Occasionally, they remain inverted despite all efforts to evert them. Other than for cosmetics, nipple inversion is not usually a problem. For breastfeeding, most inverted nipples will evert. Even those that do not evert may still function normally enough to allow for satisfactory infant nursing. Among the common causes for non-cyclic breast pain are trauma, infection, and chest wall pain underlying the breast tissue, in other words, muscle strain or overuse of the pectoralis major muscle. Breast cancer rarely causes breast pain in the early stages and is not usually suspected unless the symptoms persist. Hormonal causes include functional ovarian cysts and pregnancy. Women complaining of non-cyclic breast pain should have a careful examination. Common areas of tenderness include the pectoralis muscle distribution over the anterior chest wall. In this case, the muscle itself will be sore, and the breast, if palpated with two hands and not pressed against the tender muscle, will be non-tender. Pain or soreness in the pectoralis major muscle is frequently found among women who have recently engaged in strenuous physical activity, and it represents a muscle strain. Chest wall pain does not involve the nipple or areola, while cyclic breast tenderness usually does. Treatment is symptomatic with rest, some stretching exercises, and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications such as ibuprofen or naproxen. A second common area for chest wall pain is along the costal margin. Direct pressure on the costochondral cartilage without compressing the breast tissue will duplicate that pain. Compressing the chest wall with your hands placed laterally to the breast will also duplicate the pain. This costochondritis has similar etiologies to the pectoralis major muscle tenderness, and the treatment is the same. If the pain persists, referral will likely be necessary. Trauma can include vigorous coughing or vomiting. The resulting strong, sustained contractions of the intercostal muscles can lead to chest wall tenderness that may be perceived by the patient as breast pain. Now a few words about cyclic breast pain. During the days leading up to the normal menstrual flow, the breasts normally are somewhat engorged and may be somewhat tender. Following the onset of menstrual flow, these changes spontaneously resolve. If the tenderness is more than mild or is clinically bothersome, it's called cyclic breast pain or mastodynia. If you examine the patient during this time, these women also often have significantly enhanced nodularity of the breast tissue. The combination of cyclic breast pain and symmetrically thickened nodularity of the breast tissue is often called fibrocystic disease, although that's a misnomer because it's not really a disease, or fibrocystic breast changes. While it's not dangerous, women with cyclic mastodynia find it annoying, and in its most severe form, it interferes with some normal activities. Some women find that by reducing or eliminating their intake of caffeine, such as is found in coffee, tea, or cola drinks, and taking vitamin E supplements, 400 IUs per day, has seemed to improve their symptoms. Whether such improvement is pharmacologic or placebo in nature is still under debate. Any pharmacologic approach that suppresses ovulation will be very helpful in treating cyclic mastodynia. Among these, birth control pills are the simplest. Taking birth control pills in the usual fashion generally improves the pain significantly. For those who still experience significant pain, continuous birth control pills will usually suppress the pain completely. Also effective, by virtue of ovulation inhibition, are depomedroxyprogesterone acetate, Lupron, or Danicrin, the latter two usually justified only in severe cases due to their significant side effects. Nipple discharge. Normally, if the milk ducts are stripped towards the nipple, a drop or two of clear, milky, or greenish-tinged liquid will appear. This is not considered nipple discharge. If the nipples spontaneously leak discharge, staining the clothing, that's not normal, nor is it normal to have bloody nipple discharge. Nipple discharge from both breasts indicates galactorrhea. While a few postpartum women will continue to leak small amounts of milk for years following delivery, galactorrhea in general indicates the need for a serum prolactin measurement and possibly an MRI of the pituitary gland to look for prolactin-secreting pituitary adenomas. Hypothyroidism can also cause this problem, although that's rare. Athletes may experience small amounts of galactorrhea from constant rubbing of the nipples against clothing. Frequent sexual stimulation of the breasts may have similar effects. The serum prolactin measurement is best made after a few days of non-stimulation of the breast. Even after a breast exam, it is often helpful to wait 2 days before measuring the serum prolactin. Persistent discharge from a single duct, particularly if it is bloody, rust-colored, or multicolored, suggests the presence of an intraductal lesion, such as an intraductal papilloma. While these are often benign, they need further exploration with a general or breast surgeon. Paget's disease is a crusty, flaking lesion associated with an underlying breast malignancy, invasive, or in situ. While the appearance may be suggestive of Paget's disease, the diagnosis is generally confirmed by a nipple biopsy. The onset of the lesion is often so gradual that by the time it comes to the attention of the physician, many months or even years have passed since its onset. Treatment depends on the character and the extent of the underlying lesion. If a dominant mass is found in the breast which persists through the menstrual cycle, it's usually biopsied, either through fine needle aspiration or excisional biopsy, depending on the clinical circumstances. Suspicious masses are usually biopsied right away. These would include masses that are large, irregular, hard, fixed in place, having redness and dimpling of the overlying skin and nipple retraction. Most masses are benign, but for those found to be malignant, earlier intervention is thought by many physicians to lead to improved chances of successful treatment. Breast cysts present as smooth, non-tender masses. They will often disappear over the course of the menstrual cycle, but those that persist will need further evaluation. Cyst aspiration is frequently attempted using a small needle and syringe. Aspiration of the cyst fluid is performed primarily to confirm the fact that it really is a cyst and to decompress it. Many physicians discard the cyst fluid unless it is bloody, as cyst fluid cytologic examination is felt to be of little value. Following decompression of the cyst, the patient returns for periodic follow-up to look for recurrence. Recurrent cysts in the same location are often subjected to excisional biopsy or fine needle aspiration biopsy. Fat necrosis presents as a breast mass with surrounding ecchymosis. It may be tender, and a history of breast trauma is identified in about half the cases. Even when significant trauma is not identified, trauma is still felt to be the general cause of this condition. This benign condition is self-resolving, but is of clinical importance because it mimics the dominant mass found in breast cancer. Those cases with a typical presentation can be followed to make sure they completely resolve. Those cases that are not typical, or if there's any doubt, can have a fine needle aspiration to confirm the diagnosis. Fibroadenomas are common, benign, solid, round, or oval breast tumors, and they are most common among women ages 15 to 35. They're rubbery in consistency, mobile, and non-tender, and they rarely grow larger than 2 to 3 centimeters. The diagnosis is usually suspected on physical exam and confirmed with fine needle aspiration or excisional biopsy. When found in teenagers, we often simply watch them because of the very low risk of malignancy compared to the architectural disturbance caused by excisional biopsy. Breast cancer is a relatively common cancer, representing about 30% of all cancers in women. In broad terms, treatment is successful in about 3 out of 4 patients in controlling or eliminating the cancer. In about 1 out of 4, the cancer proves to be fatal. The risk of developing breast cancer increases steadily with increasing age. It is rare among women under age 25, but it does affect nearly 1 in 9 of those women reaching age 90. A number of factors are associated with an increased risk of developing breast cancer, including a strong family history of breast cancer, menopause after age 55, or no-term pregnancy prior to age 35. Despite the increased risk, most, about 80%, most breast cancer occurs in women not at increased risk for developing a breast cancer. For that reason, efforts at early detection are not focused just on those with somewhat increased risks, but on all women. The primary strategy involves a three-armed effort: periodic or annual professional breast exams, monthly self-breast exams, and mammography at appropriate intervals. The underlying assumption of all breast screening programs is that if we can detect a breast malignancy when it is very small, then the outcome will be better for the patient than if we discover the problem when it is bigger. Just how true that assumption is and the exact parameters of that truth are still under debate, as is the effectiveness of any of the breast cancer screening programs in improving outcome for women with breast cancer. Once a year, a woman's breast should be evaluated by a qualified health professional. Any significant abnormalities in texture, contour, skin, any palpable masses, retractions, dimpling, or nipple discharge will require follow-up appropriately for the abnormality. Professional breast exams are felt to be about 80% reliable in detecting significant breast abnormalities. Once a month, a woman should examine her own breasts, looking for changes in appearance, texture, or nipple discharge that was not previously present. Examination technique is not obvious, but is a skill to be learned and taught. Any new findings should be promptly reported to the woman's physician or other qualified healthcare provider. Most breast cancers are first noted by the patient herself. Some critics of self-breast exam observe that they may cause more problems than they solve. By the time a breast cancer is large enough for the woman to feel it herself, it's not likely to be an early breast cancer. Further, most of the self-discovered breast lumps are benign and do not represent a threat. Nonetheless, they are often subjected to investigation, including biopsy and excision. The goal of mammography is to detect very early cancers or precancerous changes before they have a chance to develop into a more advanced and dangerous stage. Mammography is felt to be about 80% effective in detecting significant breast abnormalities, but many of the ones that are missed by mammogram can be detected by examination. There is ongoing controversy over how frequently mammograms should be performed. If there is a clinical abnormality, mammograms can be used to gain additional information about the abnormality, in other words, a diagnostic mammogram. Many physicians recommend that screening mammograms be performed every other year between ages 40 and 50 and annually thereafter. Some physicians dispute the usefulness of mammograms prior to age 50. Some physicians recommend mammograms more often if there is a strong family history of breast cancer. Some physicians dispute the value of screening mammograms after age 75 or 80, and some physicians dispute the value of screening mammograms at any time. Breast ultrasound is used in some countries, although not commonly in the United States, to screen for breast cancer. It has the advantage that it is relatively inexpensive, quick, painless, and uses no radiation. It is particularly good at detecting cystic masses, probably better than mammograms. In skilled hands, it does a fair job of detecting malignancies. Unfortunately, it's not as good at detecting malignancies as mammograms, and so it's not usually used for primary screening in the United States. It is commonly used in the United States, however, as an adjunctive method to identify abnormalities palpated by the examiner or identified on mammograms. Thermography is a means of looking at the breast with an infrared or heat-sensitive imaging device. It relies on the principle that cancers have increased metabolic activity, generating more heat that can be detected with the thermographic process. While this has some theoretical advantages over other imaging techniques, in practice, thermography has not been demonstrated to be effective in early detection of significant lesions, and so it's not generally used as a primary screening technique. MRI, or magnetic resonance imaging, is sometimes used in the diagnosis and management of breast cancer. It changes the surgical management in as many as 1 out of 4 patients if performed preoperatively. In high-risk patients, in other words, those with a lifetime risk greater than 20%, it seems to have greater sensitivity at detection of malignancies not found on routine mammograms, breast ultrasound, or professional breast exams. Unfortunately, MRIs are significantly more expensive than other methods of detection, limiting their use for screening in the general population. Thanks for listening to the OBGYN 101 Gray Hair Notes. And don't forget to go online to www.obgyn101.org for the multimedia edition. This edition combines text with pictures, graphics, and videos, all designed to help you master the third year OBGYN learning objectives. Also, listen to more Gray-Haired Notes at www.grayhairedobgyn.com. See ya!